Thank you for listening. You're listening to Medicine Remix.
Thank you for calling the Medicine Remix hotline. Please leave
message
at the sound of the beep. Thank you.
Hey guys, this is Eric Madrid. I'm a family physician, Southern California. Just came across your podcast. I'm new on Anchor, so I was kind of looking to see what was out there and found your guys' stuff. I started listening to it, and I like what you guys have. I'm glad you were able to find a nice outlet to help balance this crazy life of medicine that we all have undertaken. Anyway, talk to you guys later. All right, have a good evening.
What's really good, Remixed Hood? It's your boy Reesh. It's your podcast, Medicine Remixed. And today's episode is another installment of our Doctor Mentories interview series, where we talk to doctors from various specialties in medicine that vibe with the remix culture that we're trying to create on our show, Medicine Remixed. And our guest today is Dr. Eric Madrid, who is a board-certified family medicine doctor with an interest in holistic medicine, otherwise known as root cause medicine, and we will talk about what that means in this episode. Dr. Madrid received his bachelor's degree in microbiology and molecular genetics at UCLA. He then graduated from medical school at The Ohio State University School of Medicine and completed his family medicine residency at Presbyterian Intercommunity Hospital in Whittier, California, where he served as chief resident. He currently practices at the Rancho Family Medical Group, which is affiliated with the Loma Linda Medical Center, and he is also an assistant clinical professor at the University of California Riverside School of Medicine. He's the author of The Vitamin D Prescription, The Healing Power of the Sun and How It Can Save Your Life. So you already know we're going to be talking about some vitamin D in this episode.
Yeah.
And Dr. Madrid's writing has also been featured on Kevin MD, and his podcast Heal Thyself has been featured on Apple Podcasts' Top Health Podcasts and has even made appearances on the top overall charts several times. This episode covers a lot of ground, from nutrition and supplements, doctors doing social media and podcasting, and the perspective hacking nature of doing medical missionary work. There's a lot of valuable nuggets in this one for anyone listening, so without further ado, enjoy this phenomenal documentary interview with Dr. Eric Madrid on the one and only Medicine Remixed.
Hello.
Hey, Eric.
Hey, what's going on?
How's it going, man? It's Reesh.
Hey, nice to talk to you, Reesh.
Nice to talk to you, too. Thanks so much for agreeing to do this.
Absolutely.
So I was on your Instagram stories earlier to see what you're up to, and it looks like you were up in Big Bear Mountain.
I am, yeah. Big Bear is a kind of a mountain resort here in Southern California, and we're blessed to have a kind of a second home up here. So I'll frequently come up here just to relax and do some extra reading and studying and writing, and you know, try to help my brain get a little bit more creative as I get away from the busyness of everyday life down the hill.
Oh, that's awesome. How often do you do that?
I come up here about twice per month, usually about 2 weekends per month at least. Oh. Sometimes more, but at minimum twice per month.
Okay. And is that something that you do with your family, or you kind of go up there alone?
It varies. The kids, you know, I have three kids. My oldest is 20. I have a 17-year-old and a 16-year-old. The first year, they were actually very excited, you know, coming up here. And then now they're kind of over it. So
yeah.
I'm kind of like, hey, if you guys don't want to go, that's fine. I'm going.
Right.
Sometimes my wife will come up here with me as well. So it just kind of depends. But it's only about an hour and a half drive from my house. So it's not that big of a deal.
That's great. Yeah, I definitely want to dive into some of your routines and practices. I mean, it sounds like you have so much stuff going on, from, you know, your family medicine practice, and you're also, you know, teaching medical students, and that you do a lot on social media, and you have the podcast, you're a husband, you're a father, and, you know, kind of how you balance all of those things. I definitely want to get into a little bit later. But one of the things that we try to do to kind of start off these interviews, I mean, we consider doctors like the closest thing society has to actual superheroes, without, you know, sounding too corny, but we want to typically start these interviews by asking what your first comic book kind of looks like for you. In other words, what is the Eric Madrid MD, aka holistic health man? What is the origin story there?
Well, yeah. So it's interesting. I've been interested in, holistic medicine, integrative medicine, actually ever since I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And part of that, actually, I was inspired by an aunt of mine who was an RN, and she also was interested in using medicine or using food and herbs as medicines as opposed to pharmaceuticals.
I like this right here.
So she kind of actually taught me and gave me some information. And to me, it just made a lot of sense that if we as future healers, or as a future doctor, if I could help encourage patients to live a healthy lifestyle and eat appropriately, that, that would obviously bring a lot of satisfaction. And I always have said that to me, it's a lot more satisfying to help prevent 100 or 1,000 patients from having a heart attack or a stroke than to actually try to treat them after it's already happened.
Right.
But interestingly, I actually started off upon graduating from high school. I wanted to be a doctor, but like a lot of people, I thought it was going to take too long. And I was kind of thinking I might settle for second best. And I actually started off as a business major.
Okay.
Fortunately, I went to a community college because, changing majors would have been very expensive otherwise.
Right.
So I spent 2 years at Cerritos Community College in the suburbs of Los Angeles here in Southern California, taking a lot of business classes and so on. But deep inside, I still had a desire to be a doctor.
I'm going to be a doctor.
So about 2 years after, when I was just about ready to transfer, I kind of had a wake up call and said, why am I doing this? I'm not going to enjoy, I'm going to have regrets in my life if I don't pursue medicine. So then I actually switched over to a science major and ended up spending 4 years at a community college in total before I transferred to UCLA.
Okay.
Ironically, right, my first concern was I didn't want to waste time. And there I was spending a couple extra years because I had changed my majors. But again, I think education in any form is never really a waste.
Yeah.
And it would soon turn out that it would be of my benefit later on, that business education. So, of course, I go to UCLA, microbiology, molecular genetics. I ended up going to medical school at Ohio State, or the Ohio State, as it's known in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Californians, as you may know or may not know, end up leaving the state. I think, are you from California?
No, actually, like the opposite, from New York.
Oh,
okay. Okay. Yeah, yeah. That's right. So a lot of Californians, because there's so many people here, a lot of Californians end up leaving the state of California to go to medical school. And I was one of those.
Okay.
So I ended up going to Ohio State, did my family medicine residency. And as you know, there's so much material to cover while in medical school and even residency. We're just trying to keep our head above water and trying to learn everything that we need to learn.
I can't breathe.
And obviously, under that traditional approach, there was not much focus and attention put to nutrition and right. holistic medicine and integrative approaches. So it kind of fell by the wayside, I'll be honest. I kind of, spent those 7 years of med school and residency just kind of trying to learn basic medicine. And then upon, graduating from residency, I kind of, my flame got reignited, and I started, just reading more, learning more, going to conferences, studying more, and just really deepening my knowledge in holistic medicine, functional medicine, integrated medicine, and really trying to, practice more of what now seems like a lot of people are calling root cause medicine, trying to get to the root cause of the problem as opposed to simply giving a pharmaceutical for a symptom.
Right.
And that's kind of where I am now. I'm kind of more of an integrative doctor. I'm, certified in family medicine, but, and I obviously treat people conventionally, but a lot of times we'll use an integrative approach and really promote diet and lifestyle changes. And when appropriate, if there's certain supplements that can be effective, we'll add that or use that either in place of or in addition to certain, pharmaceutical drugs that the patient may need.
Right. Kind of going along with that, the word holistic in general can have somewhat of a polarizing effect. So like, how do you, go about defining what a holistic approach is, especially for, people within medicine that might be critics of kind of the connotations of what's a holistic medical approach using supplements and, other entities that aren't the traditional treatments modalities that we use?
Right. Well, I think if you just think of the term holistic, it means really just kind of taking a comprehensive approach.
So
one of the things in medicine is that we tend to take a very linear approach. So if a patient has high cholesterol, the commercials say, when diet and exercise is not enough, talk to your doctor about, Lipitor or whatever the medication is.
When diet and exercise are not enough, adding Lipitor may help.
But let's face it. I mean, diet and exercise is almost never very limitedly counseled to patients, right? Because the kind of system that we have, it's so rushed. We have our 15-minute appointments. We're just trying to solve a problem, give a person a drug, and get on to the next patient. But in reality, that approach to someone with high cholesterol really should be discussing our insomnia or anxiety or depression or whatever the problem is. We really should be discussing diet, nutrition, exercise. How is that individual balancing their life? How are their relationships? How are they sleeping at nighttime? So in reality, that is a holistic approach, just taking all these aspects into consideration. But I think we're frequently too quick to jump to the pharmaceutical.
Talk to them.
Right? We say the patient comes in with high cholesterol, they see the cardiologist, they, had McDonald's three times that week, but because they're on 80 of atorvastatin, their cholesterol looks great. And the heart doctor says, hey, great job. Whatever you're doing, keep it up.
Whoa. Right.
And a lot of times these medicines can become an excuse for us, it's almost like they wipe away evidence of the, of the crime scene.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that, because, as you were kind of talking about this, I was reminded about the movie Minority Report. Have you seen that movie?
It's been a while, yes.
Yeah, but you know what I'm talking about, the whole idea of like pre-crime, like preventing a crime before it happens.
They were going to be waiting for me in the car.
He was going to rape me.
I was going to be stabbed.
Right here. Within a year, pre-crime effectively stopped murder in our nation's capital.
And, thinking about the analog in medicine, it's like, wouldn't it be so great if we had a system like that? And then it's like, wait, we actually do. We actually do have that system, and we know what's going to kill you, yet we don't really treat it as like this amazing thing that we have to be able to prevent disease. So I'm totally with you. Yeah.
I'll give you a quick example here too of a way that we kind of missed the boat. So when we think, let's take hypothyroidism, for example, right? Mm-hmm. If you go online, if you look up at Mayo Clinic, .com or, Merck Manual or any of the leading medical journals, you'll see that the leading cause of hypothyroidism worldwide is iodine deficiency, right?
Mm-hmm.
The leading cause of thyroid nodules worldwide is iodine deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When was the last time you've ever seen an endocrinologist or a primary care doctor check an iodine level on a patient?
Almost never. Yeah.
Right. And because we've been taught that the reason being is because since we supplement or since we fortify our salt with iodine, that we don't have iodine deficiency in this country. Right. But when was the last time you told the patient to add all the salt they want to their food? Right.
True. Yeah.
For the last 20 years, we've been doing the exact opposite. We say avoid salt.
Yeah.
Right. And interestingly, I think it was a 2013 study based on the NHANES data, the government kind of gets together nutrition and health information and dietary information and puts out a report. And in the United States, so they looked at people in the United States. Okay. This is a few years ago. In the United States, 10 to 11% of the U.S. population has a mild to moderate iodine deficiency.
Won't air.
Okay. And this is based on government data. It's not, it's not conspiracy medicine journal, right? It's mainstream thyroid medicine journals.
Right.
10 to 11% have a mild to moderate deficiency. And if you were to actually factor in a mild deficiency, based on that, I would estimate probably another 10%. So we're talking almost 1 in 5 people in the United States have an iodine deficiency, either mild, moderate, or severe. Interestingly, 10% of the population has thyroid disease. But again, so my approach to medicine is like, hey, let's try to get to the root cause. Yeah, you have thyroid nodules. You have an underactive thyroid. My own daughter actually had an iodine deficiency.
Mm.
And, so we're treating her just with a multivitamin. I'm not getting, I'm not getting crazy. But again, but the fact is that, if we didn't, know this, we wouldn't look. And the fact is, 10 to 20% is a pretty high number for us to completely ignore.
Oh, yeah. No, that's significant.
So that's how I use holistic medicine. I kind of, go back to the basics. I think sometimes we get too caught up in all the science and too caught up in, in all the medications. I've had many patients, go into AFib in the hospital and and they're on, you know, proton pump inhibitors and diuretics, and, you know, neither the ER doctor or their cardiologist, you know, ever checked a magnesium level. So I also admit patients. I kind of also work as one of our hospitalists for our medical group. But sure enough, I'll check the magnesium level, and it's severely low. And I've had cases where patients did not respond till diltiazem, but all of a sudden we give them a bolus of magnesium and they go back into a, you know, they convert back to a normal sinus rhythm, or they at least become rate controlled.
Right.
Diltiazem is great and it works, but sometimes, again, we forgot the basics. Hey, let's check this person's magnesium level.
Yeah, it's so amazing.
So I think that's what I try to do with the med students, you know, that come and rotate with us. I say, hey, all this stuff that we're learning is super important, but don't rebuild the engine without, you know, first checking to make sure there's gas and oil in the car.
That's right. It seems like medicine nowadays is such a reactionary practice, like you're describing. We're just throwing pills and surgery at things, whereas we're not really emphasizing what the root cause is and changing people's lifestyles. So as, you know, new agey as some people might find some of these practices, it's actually like going back to the fundamentals, essentially, and really, you know, going back to the basics. And I think it's easy to lose sight of that with the culture of medicine nowadays. You know, just as far as the, since we're talking about supplements and things like that, the supplement industry is another like very controversial sector of our society because of how highly unregulated it is and how little evidence there actually is about so many products that are out there.
If you're a supplement company today, you do not need approval from the FDA before a product is marketed. You can make health claims without prior approval from the government, and you don't have to prove the safety or effectiveness of your product before putting it up for sale.
So in your practice, what supplements, if any, do you yourself believe in and do you recommend to your patients? And what supplements do you caution against, if any?
So again, the one that I use most commonly, honestly, would just be a simple multivitamin, for example, for patients, because so many of us have a poor diet and, you know, depending on our stress levels, you know, we each have kind of a unique metabolic demands, right? Not, you know, not everybody needs to drink 8 glasses of water a day, right? If you're 90 years old with congestive heart failure, that's going to worsen your symptoms. You know, if you're a marathon runner and you're running 10 to 15 miles, you know, in training every day, and you drink 8 glasses of water a day, you're going to be dehydrated, right? You know, Shaquille O'Neal might need more nutrients than an Olympic, gymnast who's, you know, 4'10". So again, we have to realize that each person has a unique metabolic demands and requirements. So to assume that one size fits all is kind of, I think, a dangerous thing. But anyway, so number one would be a multivitamin, just because there's something like, what, 90 vitamins and minerals. So I figured we're either on a biochemical level, you either deficient, you have the exact amount you need, or you have excess.
So right.
Only one of those three things. And with our poor diet that we have, you know, chances are that we're not in excess of vitamins, and the chances of us having the exact equal amount that we need is low. So, you know, so the evidence is actually we're quite deficient in a lot of things. So that's why I start off with the multivitamins. And then depending on certain symptoms, if patients are having leg cramps, you know, migraine, headaches, I've had a lot of success using magnesium, primarily a chelated form though, not the magnesium oxide. That's not absorbed very well. And that just kind of, you know, that's great if someone has diarrhea. But usually we'll use a chelated form, like a citrate or malate or something like that, with magnesium. And I've had great success in helping to prevent migraine headaches, help get rid of nocturnal leg cramps, muscle twitches, and so on. And a lot of these patients, again, are on maybe PPIs or diuretics. So we know that those drugs actually will bring upon a magnesium deficiency.
Right.
I've had some patients, you know, I've utilized St. John's wort, for example, for some patients with mild to moderate depression. And there's pretty good evidence that, you know, St. John's wort could, you know, can work for that. And what else? I have a lot of seniors as well. And right now, you know, there's a lot of concerns or how do we treat pain in the senior citizens or just in people in general. And there's a big aversion towards using opiates. And so that kind of leads us with NSAIDs. But a lot of seniors also have chronic kidney disease, you know, stage 3, stage 4, whatever.
That's right.
So we can't really use NSAIDs on this population. We can't use narcotics on this population. Tylenol is no longer effective. So like, what do we do, you know, as healthcare providers to these patients that come to us and say, hey, I'm having severe pain. What do, you know, so I've had good success using turmeric. for example, and there's studies out there that show that it has a similar method of mode of action. It can inhibit the cyclooxygenase or act as a COX inhibitor. Mm-hmm. You know, also there's evidence that turmeric and the herb boswellia also can help reduce inflammation. And I've had many patients who've been able to either reduce their need for opiates or reduce their need for NSAIDs because they've started taking turmeric or omega-3 fish oil, and they've been able to reduce their inflammation to a tolerable level.
Yeah, that's a great point. My family is originally from India, and you know, we use a lot of turmeric in our cooking. Right. But even on top of that, you know, my background's in orthopedics, and I have had my mother start taking turmeric supplementation on top of the turmeric that we, you know, have in our diet. And, you know, again, this is probably not something that has been studied long enough for us to, you know, really prove to some people that it makes like a significant difference. But anecdotally, I will say that my mother has definitely seen a difference, and a lot of other patients that, you know, I've taken care of have as well. Do you typically recommend that they take turmeric in the pill form or also kind of like use it in their cooking, or how do you prescribe that?
Both actually. So I will encourage them to, you know, to use it in their cooking. And, you know, we have the turmeric powder in our spice cabinet. Uh-huh. And then also in a pill form as well, usually as a capsule. I usually have them take it maybe 2 to 3 times a day, around 500 milligrams. And, you know, and that helps usually at least with their baseline, and then, you know, and definitely, you know, to use it, you know, in their food as well.
Okay. And is that something that you would recommend to only people that are having pain, or is it something that you feel like everybody should be taking?
I think it's a good supplement actually for a lot of people. You know, there's other studies too that would suggest that it's also helpful for the brain and for memory, and maybe even in the prevention of Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. So I think anyone maybe with a family history of Alzheimer's disease or who's concerned about memory, it could be a helpful herb. From some of my research too, I think, you know, Alzheimer's disease is definitely something obviously becoming more and more common as the population ages, but it's not necessarily as common in India, where there's a high turmeric intake. And as you probably know too, so the active ingredient in turmeric is the curcumin,
right?
Which is where we get the word curry.
Right.
So, but India in general, you know, they tend to have a higher intake of the turmeric and curcumin. So maybe in a roundabout way that contributes to the reduced incidence of Alzheimer's disease compared to, you know, those in the Western hemisphere.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, one of the other things that I have read, and it's obviously multifactorial, and I need to revisit this literature, but also, you know, speaking more than one language, I've heard, has also helped with kind of reducing the risk of like early onset dementia and maybe even Alzheimer's. But you know, from the pathophysiology of Alzheimer's being related to, you know, inflammation and things like that, I guess, you know, that's probably why there is a correlation that turmeric may reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. Am I right in kind of thinking that way?
Yeah, I've heard that as well. And from what I've read too, turmeric also helps increase BDNF, which is called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. So it's kind of a protein, I guess, or a factor that's made in the brain that helps with neurogenesis, or, you know, neuroplasticity of the brain. So basically helps new nerves to, you know, we used to believe, when I was in med school, actually, we used to believe that the brain could not be, you know, regenerated.
Right.
Or, you know, once you lose brain tissue, that's it. And now we know otherwise, that the brain is very plastic and it can be regenerated. But, you know, every thought, everything we learn, every experience we have are actually creating new neurons and new connections. And that BDNF is one of those factors that's really important to do that. So yeah, so turmeric helps with that. Exercise helps with that. Uh-huh. You know, so, and this is what I tell patients too, and they're worried about memory loss even. I say, hey, you need, not only do you need to eat right and have a diet, you know, rich in antioxidants and fruits and vegetables and, you know, these certain supplements that, you know, can potentially be helpful, but you need to exercise as well. And I think, again, the problem with Western medicine is we're like, oh, you have memory issues. Here's some Aricept. Here's some Namenda. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's not working. And, you know, we just kind of leave it at that. And again, it's never that simple. You know, while those medicines may be helpful, they might only be a small part of that equation. So if there's 20 things contributing to a person's memory loss, we need to address all 20 things. And that's again, goes back to being a holistic approach, right?
Yeah.
You know, and you got to address all 20, whereas each individual one, you may not notice any significant difference. And that's why maybe a lot of these studies don't show benefit, because it's kind of like giving a person who's in debt a dollar. And of course, they don't go out of debt with the dollars. So therefore, the conclusion is money will not get you out of debt.
Right.
It's just not enough. You know, we need to address the whole thing.
That's right. Yeah, that's a great point. You know, in prepping for this interview, also, I learned that you wrote a book back in 2009 called The Vitamin D Prescription, The Healing Power of the Sun and How It Can Save Your Life. Talk about why you decided to write that book and what that process was like, writing that book in the context of being a full-time family doctor, and maybe some important points as well that you discussed in that book.
Sure. So now you have to remember, this was in 2009 in Southern California, right, which has the most sun probably of, you know, one of, you know, if almost anywhere in the world, you know, probably 330 days of sun per year. And here I am testing my patients for a vitamin D deficiency.
Right.
And at the time, there was only one other book on Amazon, and it was written like around 2001 and so on. And obviously it didn't get much traction, because it took, you know, almost another decade for vitamin D deficiency to become become commonly known and accepted. So I've always been kind of a contrarian. So kind of, you know, go against the grain in whatever aspect of life. And so I'm trying to remember exactly how I think it was a patient who came to me, and they said, hey, the patient came to me, she had really bad fibromyalgia. And she said, hey, can you check my vitamin D level? I'm like, we're in Southern California, your vitamin D level is great. She's like, no, I was reading this thing on the internet. Right. And again, this is like 2007, maybe 2006. So the internet, you know, in many cases didn't, you know, it was kind of a joke back then. Right? Would you see that? The internet?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, a little more credibility. So she's like, you know, I read it, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, just being open minded, I said, hey, let me look at what you got. And, you know, let me see. So I look up, I do some research on vitamin D deficiency. I look up the Merck manual, and it talks about vitamin D deficiency can cause muscle aches, joint pains. And I'm like thinking, oh my gosh, this sounds like fibromyalgia.
Right.
I almost by the definition there. So I go ahead and order a vitamin D 25 hydroxy level on her. And sure enough, her level was low. It was like 12.
Mm.
And I was like, wow, this is amazing. You know, what's going on here? So, you know, so I had a couple other patients with fibromyalgia, and at this point, I'm like, you know, I'm going to test them too, right? I had like maybe five or six patients.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, all of them were deficient.
Whoa.
Wow.
And so I started going to my colleagues. I'm like, hey, look, I've been checking these people for vitamin D deficiency. And they're like, yeah, sure. This is Southern California. What are you doing? I'm like, look, I actually had to bring the lab results to the meetings to show them. And I kind of got their attention. And so that's kind of where it started. And then I just started doing more and more research and, started reading a lot of the journal articles that were out there. There's a Dr. Hollick out of Boston who kind of one of the vitamin D gurus and has done a lot of research on it. There is a organization down in San Diego, a couple doctors out of UCSD who found that geographical locations where there was less vitamin D, that there are higher rates of colon cancer and breast cancer.
Mm. God.
And then, of course, I remember the med school, right? They teach us the latitude and how that increases one's risk for multiple sclerosis, right? So then I started researching that. So, you know, because I kind of have like an ADHD personality,
yeah. What
started off, I'm thinking, hey, I'm just going to write like a 6-page article and maybe submit it to the American Academy of Family Physicians.
Uh-huh.
I was kind of like Forrest Gump. I just kind of kept going and going.
No particular reason. I just kept on going.
Next thing you know, I was up to like 200 pages,
right?
And, you know, printing up, you know, just hundreds, if not thousands of articles. And then I ended up, publishing my book back in 2009 and then kind of the whole vitamin D wave, you know, and it's had its controversy in a sense since then, you know, like whether or not supplementing is really helpful or not. And, you know, a whole bunch of studies say yes, a few studies say no. And, you know, I think it goes back and forth.
Right.
But in either case, it definitely, you know, we're still relatively early in understanding the vitamin D, which is actually a hormone, mm-hmm. a steroid hormone, and how it can affect overall health. And I'm actually thinking of, can't believe it's already been 9 years since I wrote the book.
Yeah.
So I'm actually thinking of starting an updated version here for the 10-year anniversary and And so maybe I'll have something coming out next year. Yeah! 2019, an updated version.
Yeah, that would definitely be timely. And, you know, I totally agree. I feel like I hear so much more about vitamin D these days. So I feel like you were, you know, definitely a pioneer back in 2009, you know, writing about themes related to that. So how did you go about, you wind up like self-publishing that, or what was that process like?
Yeah, so initially I was looking for publishers and it was kind of difficult. So then I ended up self-publishing it through Amazon, mm-hmm. which made it nice. And then I reached out to some other literary agents. And if you recall back in 2009, 2008, it was kind of during the economic collapse.
Oh, yeah.
The stock market was down. And I met with a guy in Manhattan, a book publisher. I was real excited just to even meet with him and stuff. But at the time, publishing companies were being real skeptical and real hesitant because of the, you know, just the economic crisis that was going on. And, you know, people had less discretionary income. So at least that's what he told me, that, you know, that nonfiction and so on were, you know, kind of risky at that point. So, and I said, okay, that's fine. I just ended up self-publishing it and pretty much, you know, it went through Amazon, and that's kind of where, you know, majority of things are purchased, at least when it comes to books nowadays anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's worked out good.
Yeah, no, that was great timing. And as far as the amount of time that it took you to kind of compile all of that research, you started that kind of in 2007, kind of prompted by this patient. And how long did it take you, and how did you kind of find the pockets of time in your day to put that together?
Man, it wasn't easy. So yeah, so I started researching it in 2007. It was probably when I started seriously writing the book, it was probably mid 2008. Mm-hmm. And literally I would, you know, before I would leave my office at the end of the day, I would go on PubMed, pull up a couple articles, print them up, go home and read them, and, you know, sit down on my computer for an hour or two while, you know, my kids were doing their homework or my wife was doing her work, or sometimes even when we were watching a family movie, right? So that's tough. But, you know, I frequently tend to do that when we're watching, you know, TV, or we're watching TV, just because I don't like to, I try to be productive as much as possible when I'm awake.
Yeah, so, yeah.
I think most of us try to multitask to the best degree possible. So I would just write, you know, a few pages here and a few pages there, and knock out some more on the weekends. And, you know, like I said, about a year later, it was, I think it's around a couple hundred pages, 210 pages or something like that. And just slowly kind of, you know, worked on it over the course of a year.
That's phenomenal. I mean, I feel like so many doctors now, especially with the rise of social media and having an outlet to kind of get their message out there, there are, you know, so many platforms, including, you know, podcasting now. How did you kind of get started in social media and with the podcasting, and what, like, daily routines, if any, do you have? And it may be similar to kind of what you just discussed about your book and finding time to, right, to get that time in with social media and podcasting, but kind of take me through your journey in social media and ultimately finding podcasting and how that all kind of went down.
Right. So I've always been very creative, you know, a creative spirit in that sense. I'm always like trying to create new things, do new things, and kind of push the limits. And so my first, you know, like most people, you know, my first experience with social media was MySpace, right? Where everyone's best friend was Tom. And you know, that was back in the early, you know, 2000s or so. And I remember when I got my first Mac computer, this was probably like in 2005, 2006. And this whole idea of podcasting was pretty exciting. Again, my dates might be off a couple of years, but I think it was around 2006, maybe 2007,
yeah,
the latest when I got my
right
first Mac. And there was this thing called podcast, and I'm like, wow, this is great. So I would experiment actually back then on my Mac, and I actually made a couple of podcasts back then, but I didn't have the time really, or the material in the sense, the variety and the diversity of material and the time to do the editing as well. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot more complicated than it is now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like the Anchor app is just amazing.
Yeah.
And so I dabbled with it, you know, a decade ago, and then it kind of went on the back burner. And I think I was using Podbean, I think, at the time, and they ended up removing the podcast because, you know, nothing happened with them for a couple, you know, for many years. Mm-hmm. So then we kind of jumped forward, and, you know, like I said, I have three kids. My wife and I, we had them while I was in medical school, mm-hmm. which in residency, which is not necessarily advised, but, you know, it's difficult, but now that they're older, it's kind of nice because I'm only 46, so I'm able to have that freedom. But anyway, so, you know, of course, then with the kids and the social media, you know, I don't want to be one of those old dads, you know, and totally out of the loop. Right. So I had to kind of keep my social media skills up. Mm-hmm. I got my Instagram account like 3-4 years ago, and of course Facebook, which now I guess is the old person's social media.
That's right.
Snapchat, you know, downloaded that like a year ago, but didn't really use it. It was more just to spy on my kids and make sure they were staying out of trouble. And but, you know, then my wife is a little bit more into social media, so she would like show me like, this is how you do a story and this is how you do it and stuff. So then I would, you know, I posted stuff like to Instagram a few years ago, and you know, then I was kind of off it for a while, and then I think just with the natural growth of it, you know, I ended up with followers and so on. But I got more into it just probably this past summer and stuff, started posting more, and then when I kind of discovered Anchor and, you know, the ability to make podcasts and so on. So you know, just kind of and now, you know, doing that, I mean, working on between the Anchor podcast and, you know, working on some of my books and things that I write, blog articles that I write as well. And you know, and I just try to do that. And, you know, now that the kids are older, they don't want to really spend as much time with us parents. So I have to find, me and my wife have to find ways to not only enjoy each other, but, you know, to entertain ourselves as well.
Sure. So do you have any specific kind of routine with social media or podcasting? Like, do you have specific times of day that you kind of dedicate to that? Or is it more of like an organic kind of a process where, you know, you're just posting when you feel like it?
Yeah, I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to maybe post at least one time a day, sometimes more. And if I do it, it's maybe going to be like morning, lunchtime, in the evening, just kind of when I'm not in the clinic or when I have a little bit of spare time. But as you know, we have to really put time limits on things because, you know, you can be on social media and next thing you know, you spend 30 minutes and you're like, wow, I just wanted to post one thing and it was going to take me a minute and now it's been 30 minutes.
Right.
So it can really zap one's time. So I find it important to try to balance that out. And, you know, so if I post like right before I start seeing patients, then obviously I won't get sucked into the media to that degree because I'll have other responsibilities that I need to attend to.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, it's definitely a challenge, but I feel like it's one of these things that's really important. I mean, it depends on who you talk to, and definitely for more of the old timers in medicine, like there's still a lot of skepticism and fear around it, but I feel like the benefits far outweigh the risks as far as like how I see it. How do you think social media can be really helpful for doctors in practice?
Yeah, I think it could be very helpful in the sense of, even when I look at the med students nowadays, or we have PA students who rotate with us as well, you know, the attention span of the millennial generation is definitely shorter in one aspect. They need rapid transitioning of images, so to speak. So in one aspect, it's a way to educate as well, because, you know, the use of memes, you can really pack a lot of information and a lot of, you know, quality information. And of course, you always have to be skeptical of the source as well, because pretty much, you know, anyone can say anything and people are going to believe it. So I think it's important to, you know, kind of fact check whatever's out there as well. But if the sources are reputable and if the people have, you know, some kind of experience behind them and so on, then I think, you know, it could be a great tool for education, not only of healthcare providers, but also of just patients in general. Also, it can be a good way for healthcare providers to grow their practice, for healthcare providers maybe to get a following, so to speak, who, you know, in the future, if one has a book or some other, you know, paper or article that's written, it's easy to disseminate it to, you know, thousands and thousands of people, whereas it would have been very difficult to do that and without the use of social media.
Right. It's phenomenal. You know, your podcast has really taken off, I feel like, in a short amount of time, even though it's funny when you were talking about doing the podcast thing back in the day, me and Dee, my co-founder of Medicine Remix, we did something very similar back. It was a little later than you did, even maybe around 2010 or 11. We also kind of hosted on Podbean. And at that time we were roommates. We were like in the same place. We kind of had to be in the same place at the same time. And, you know, had all this like recording equipment and we had to edit and figure out all these RSS feeds and stuff. And then it was until much, much later that we discovered Anchor and figured out that, you know, we could be doing this remotely and, you know, in any downtime that we had in the hospital or like on our commutes and things like that. But when did you join Anchor? Was it, you know, just this past year or?
Yeah, this past year, I think I joined it maybe in May. And then, you know, like anything, you know, the first step is always the hardest thing. So I sat on it for a couple of months and had my hesitancy. I was scared. I was like, oh my, how about, you know, what if I don't, what if I sound funny? Because of course, none of us like the way we sound when we hear us.
Yeah.
So I had that, that nervousness that I think a lot of people have whenever they're trying to do something new, especially when right off the bat, knowing that I could be under the scrutiny and be evaluated by other people. And I remember just telling myself, you know what, the first 10, or maybe even the first 20 are really going to suck, but I got to just do it. And over time, it's just going to get better and better and better. So I had to just kind of stick myself out there and make it work and see what I can do. And, you know, I think I've gotten a little bit better over time, and I hope to, you know, even continue to improve as the, you know, as time goes on. So basically this summer is when I really just kind of started doing it.
No, it's amazing. And, you know, like I said, it really has taken off in a short amount of time. We've been kind of, you know, following you, you know, from afar, and congrats on the success. You've been like featured in like the top 10 health related podcasts on Apple. And we even saw you make a few appearances on, you know, the top charts overall, which is just phenomenal.
Right.
Talk a little bit about what your podcast is about and why you think it's had the response that it's had, which has been, you know, tremendous, like I said.
Thank you. Yeah, so the title of it is Heal Thyself, which interestingly, when I was even skeptical about using that title, right? Because that's kind of like an old term,
yeah.
Heal Thyself.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you know, this shows my age even more. And again, I'm only 46, but I'm thinking, is this going to appeal to, it's going to appeal maybe to the seniors, but you know, I don't know what percentage of them are listening to podcasts. I want to make sure I'm appealing to all demographics. So I called it Heal Thyself. And really my goal is to provide information and to empower people to heal themselves, right? Because it's not your job as the doctor, or it's not our jobs as the physicians. So to a degree, our job is to heal patients and to help patients and to help improve their quality of life. But we're only seeing them, you know, I mean, even if you see somebody four times a year for a 15-minute appointment, you're only spending an hour with them each year, which is just a small blip on a screen.
That's right.
And so how much information can we really give them? How much can we really do in just a 15-minute appointment that's really going to transform their life? So what we really need to do is put them on the path so that they can change their own lives, so that they can become encouraged and motivated, and to provide them with the resources, the knowledge, and the education to continue to work on themselves, to heal themselves. And, you know, I kind of feel sometimes I'm, you know, yeah, I'm kind of like a life coach and a health coach at the same time, because, you know, I can tell you something, avoid this or do that, but unless you're going to, when my patients leave the office, unless they're going to maybe read an article, read a book, or watch a documentary, perhaps on, you know, on Netflix or Amazon Prime, which I tend to promote, you know, try to encourage them to do that, since a lot of people tend to be in love with their, you know, with their TV or with their mobile phones or whatever, they can watch documentaries. But I try to encourage them, like, hey, you need to become a, you know, get a minor in nutrition.
Major killer.
You need to educate yourself, because what I'm doing is only a small aspect of it. So that's really what I'm trying to accomplish, is to encourage people to educate themselves, get a minor in nutrition, so to speak, unofficially. Learn about it, read about it, and you know, the fact is, the more we focus on something, the more we will manifest that in our life, right? So if you're focusing on health and nutrition, you're reading about it, you're more likely to eat healthier, make better decisions, you know, be more physically active, because that's what's in the forefront of your thought process. And that's really what I'm trying to accomplish here, just to empower people.
Absolutely. No, I think you're doing a tremendous job, and definitely, you know, encouraging to see how quickly people have kind of caught on. What are you doing, if anything, as far as, you know, promoting this to your patients and students?
Well, I've interviewed, for example, a medical student at Loma Linda, because he rotated with me, and I think he shared it with a lot of his friends and colleagues, so that actually got a lot of listens. And then I would use Facebook as well to promote it, where I have a pretty decent following on Facebook, and then also Instagram. And then also, as I mentioned before, my kids, you know, like most millennials nowadays, are masters of social media. So my two sons have one has almost 20,000 followers on Instagram, so he's shouted me out a few times on his story.
Awesome.
And then my other son has almost 160,000 followers, so he shouted me out a few times in the story. So that also kind of drove some traffic to the site as well.
Okay. I guess the influencers don't fall far from the tree, I guess.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, that was another thing too. My son also has a business podcast, and he started that a couple of years ago. So, you know, in a roundabout way, I was re-inspired again. I'm like, you know, if my son, and he's not even using Anchor, he's doing it the old school way. Uh-huh. But I'm thinking, hey, if my son can, you know, start a podcast and do well with it, I go, you know what, let me try this again, and let me, you know, restart this process and so on. So again, I was kind of, you know, our children inspire us in many ways, mm-hmm. you know, that we don't always realize, you know, when they're young, we don't realize how they'll inspire us when they get older. But I think any parent out there who has kids, that we're inspired in many ways by our own children, who will, you know, teach us things about ourselves that we never realized.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. You know, just a few like quick questions and we'll wrap this up. I want to be mindful of your time and let you get back to enjoying the mountain there.
Thank you.
So I found in prepping for this interview also that you've been doing missionary work in Haiti since 2006. And I just wanted you to maybe touch on how you got into doing that kind of work and any notable experiences or impacts that this work has had on your life and your practice.
Yeah, I'll be honest. Going on these missionary trips has actually been life-changing, to be rather honest. One of my colleagues, he had been going to Haiti. The current medical group I work with, it's Rancho Family Medical Group in Southern California. We're in like Southwest Riverside County, and you know, there's like we have 17, 18 doctors and probably just as many PAs and nurse practitioners. And so I joined the group back in 2005, and one of my colleagues had been going to Haiti for about 10 years or so, about 7 years at that point. And he got interested because his patients, he had a couple of patients who had started a non-denominational, it's a religious-based, Christian-based, but it's a non-denominational missionary group. So he basically added the medicine to it. So we would go out there and basically provide medical outreach to those in the what's called the Central Plateau of Haiti. It's about a 3-hour drive from Port-au-Prince. And I've gone probably about a dozen times over the last 10 years. We go for about 1 week at a time. And I'll be honest, like, it's really changed my life in the sense of, you know, I mean, let's face it, everyone has problems. We all have problems. And even here in the United States, right, the richest country in the world, one of the highest standard of living in the world. But yet we're still anxious. We're still depressed. We still have insomnia. And then I kind of realized that a lot of it really just comes down to perspective, because I've been to, you know, for the most part, even the poorest here in this country, for the most part, I mean, there's always exceptions, but for the most part, we pretty much have a roof over our head. We, you know, pretty much are getting at least one meal a day and so on. And, you know, and obviously we have higher expectations for, you know, for us here in America, but, you know, we have clothes, you know, we have shoes for the most part. And when I went to Haiti, it just broke my heart, because, you know, there's still so many people there who don't even have the basic necessities that we all take for granted. So, and by that I mean shelter, right? Or they might live in an adobe-like house with mud walls and a thatched roof. So of course, when it rains, which it frequently does over there, you know, water leaks into the house, and then they have a dirt floor. Or they may not have shoes, so there's a lot of kids, you know, running around with no shoes on. You know, or they have to walk 5 or 6 miles to a well to, you know, to be able to provide water, to get water for the family. And so it really just kind of, I think, allowed me to appreciate the situation that I'm in and that we are in here in the United States, but then also just to be more mindful of others around the world and saying, hey, you know, when we're in a position where we can help others and provide medical care and do things, that we need to make sure we give back, because not everyone has the good fortune, you know, that we have. I mean, to see a kid, for example, I had one patient there, and he was probably about 9 years old, and he comes up to see us, and he has pus coming out of his ear.
Oh, God.
Right? Mm. A horrible case of otitis media. He has a ruptured tympanic membrane, a ruptured eardrum. And I asked them, I go, how long has this been going on? And they said, 3 weeks. So this kid has pus coming out of his ear for 3 weeks because they didn't have the money to get an antibiotic, or they didn't have the resources there to see a doctor so they could get an antibiotic, which, you know, really just cost, you know, maybe a couple of dollars wholesale.
Wow.
And so, of course, we gave him the antibiotics and, you know, and he was able to get better and stuff. But again, you know, things like that. And it's only a 2-hour flight from Miami. It's a tragedy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think really perspective is a very valuable medicine. And it's, you know, definitely something that I get quite a bit every time I, you know, go back to see where my parents grew up in India.
Right.
And there's so many places like that around the world when, you know, you really start to see the difference between third world problems and first world problems. And I think there's nothing like actually being in the setting itself to really drive that point home.
Right.
How often do you get to do this?
I go to Haiti once a year. And and just recently, actually, about 2-3 weeks ago, I came back from the Philippines, which is the first time I had done a mission trip to the Philippines.
Okay.
So that was fun and exciting. And so we had about 7 or 8 days of medical outreach, and then about 4 days of just R&R and fun and relaxation. So that was nice.
Yeah, yeah. Is that typically the time frame that you spend in Haiti as well? You're there for like a little over a week?
Yeah, so Haiti tends to be about 7 days just because it's a little easier to get there. And then Philippines, it's about a 12 to 14 day trip.
Amazing. And you do this through your practice, essentially? Or
I do, yeah, I do. So there's okay. About 3 or 4 other doctors in our practice, and then we'll go various times throughout the year to Haiti or to the Philippines, always making sure that we don't leave at the same time, in the sense,
right.
Because it'd be too much work for those who stay behind.
Right.
But one of the nice things too, I think, about going, doing these medical outreach trips too, medical mission trips, is one of the things that it kind of helped reinvigorate my excitement for medicine too, because I feel that when we go there, we can simply just be doctors, right?
Yeah.
And we're not worried about, is this drug covered? You know, because we take medicines with us.
Right.
So we have our formulary that we're going to work from. But again, we're not worried like, hey, let me give you a prescription. It's not covered. Oh, I'm going to get a call back and from the pharmacy.
Yeah.
Or I don't have to spend, if I spend 10 minutes or 15 minutes with a patient, I don't have to go spend another 10 minutes documenting the whole note, you know, the whole visit and what went on just from a med legal perspective. You know, we literally could just see patients, take care of them, do what's necessary and just keep moving on. So we'll literally see hundreds and hundreds of patients each day.
That's amazing.
So it's really nice in the sense, because it kind of brings the joy back in medicine that sometimes, you know, being a doctor is fun, but we have to admit it, healthcare providers, the fun part is, you know, for you is probably doing the surgery or are actually taking care of the patient, but the not so fun part is, you know, spending half the day on a computer, left clicking, right clicking and typing.
That's right. Yeah. No, I mean, most of the job, you know, winds up being in the documenting and the electronic medical record and dealing with insurance companies and all of those, you know, I guess, first world problems that we're dealing with. But then on the flip, in the third world, when you don't have to deal with any of that, it's just like, wow, I'm actually like way happier here because I don't have to... you know, do all of those things that are causing my first world
problems.
Exactly.
You know, because no one goes into med school and say, hey, I'm going to med school because I want to spend half my day sitting in front of a computer typing and clicking, right? We go there to help people.
That's right.
So definitely very, very enriching.
Awesome. Well, Eric, this was phenomenal. We covered a lot of different ground here. I would love to do a round two at some point as, you know, we continue to follow the success of your podcast and all the exciting things that you're doing with social media. And definitely keep us posted on the vitamin D prescription 2.0. We'll definitely promote the hell out of it on Medicine Remixed. And where can people find you in general on social media?
So on Instagram, just Eric Madrid MD, and also the same on Facebook, facebook.com/EricMadridMD.
Awesome. And, you know, we'll provide all the links in our show notes. And I'm sure you've heard a few of our episodes.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we do like kind of this mixtape style of podcasting. So we'll get this, you know, chopped up and mixed in the next few weeks. And I think people are really going to get a lot out of it.
Yeah. I feel his job, by the way, too. I really enjoy it. I enjoy the mix. And you guys do a great, great job with the sound effects. And I always look forward to listening to your episodes when they come out. So
I really appreciate that, man. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Documentary.
The documentary.
Who's the doc that he told you to go see?
This is probably one of the hardest things to do, and that's ask for help.
We need your help!
On any front, asking for help medically.
I don't need therapy.
Asking for help, LifeWise.
Need help. Need help now.
Asking for help, supporting Medicine Remix. I guess it's all uncomfortable. No easy way to do it. Until now. The folks over at Anchor have decided to unveil something that we think is pretty dope.
Ladies and gentlemen.
It's called Listener Support. And the way it works is you go to anchor.fm/medicineremixed and it'll take you to our page. There's a support button. Click on it. Follow what it says. And bam, you have now donated the vital blood to this organism that it needs to keep on pumping. Thanks for listening. Medicine Remix.